Thursday Night Football with John Giles.
Johnny Giles is a national treasure. When he speaks, I mean, I'm like, yes, yes, yes. When he's on the show, I was in the car the other day. I parked the car and I sprinted into the house and turned on the radio. I love listening to him. I love Johnny Giles.
John Giles, every Thursday at 7:30 p.m. on OTB Sports Radio, live 24/7 on the Go Loud app. The OTB Podcast Network with Virgin Media. Catch all of the UEFA Champions League and Europa League games live on Virgin Media TV.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
Chris Sutton's going to be one of our very special guests at the Pepsi Remote Roadshow on the 20th of August. It is an all-star lineup, Celtic and Villa legend Stylian Petrov, Neil Lennon, the current Celtic manager, Jason McAteer, David Moyler are also going to join Nathan on the night alongside Chris Sutton. Download the OTB Sports app for more on that and for the details of how you can get tickets. So go on to the Play Store or the App Store, download OTB Sports, click on the events and you should be able to apply for tickets for that one. Really looking forward to it. Chris Sutton also has a new book out which is called You're Better Than That, which apparently is his catch cry on 6:06 on Saturday evenings on BBC Five Live. Yesterday afternoon, Owen caught up with him for a chat.
Okay, so Chris Sutton has got a brand new book out. It's called You're Better Than That, How to Fix Modern Football. Chris, thanks a million for taking the call. How are you getting on?
Very, very well, thank you. Yeah, excited about the book. I don't get excited very often, but I am excited. It's out now, and it's going pretty well, as far as I know.
Yeah, the book is basically a 25-point manifesto on how to improve the game of football, and it's actually interesting reading this in the current climate, because a lot of what you're saying has been crystallized by the global pandemic that we've had, especially when it comes to the money swilling around in the game.
Yeah, I think that you're right in what you say. I mean, the book is about a wide variety of subjects. And first of all, you know, can I just say football? You know, I love football. Football has been my life. I love sport. And it's the game that we all love. But there are issues within the game. And within the book, it's split into five different sections. And there are various topics in the section. Sections, things like diving, I mean, you know, which has been really prominent in recent times. And we need to get on top of these things. I think it maddens people, you know, when they see players throwing themselves to the floor. But you touch on the money situation. And I mean, only this week, one of my sons said to me, do you know what? I think it's £100 to buy a new Liverpool shirt, which is, I mean, that's extraordinary. £100 for a punter to actually pay for a football shirt, which costs a tiny fraction of that to make. I mean, that's exploitation, you know, in my view. And there are, you know, many other issues within the game which needs sorting. And it's not just me having a pop at Liverpool here. It's across the board where, you know, I do feel that football clubs, they exploit fans. And that, ticket pricing is another issue.
For sure. The football shirt point is an interesting one because it's twofold. First of all, you've got the exploitation of the football fans in that way, but it's also exploiting the substance versus style issue, which you touch on quite a bit in the book, that people want to be en vogue quite a bit when it comes to their attachment with a football club, and having the brand new jersey is a really important thing. It comes back to what you talk about, your issue with coloured boots, for example.
That one's a point of principle. There's light and shade in this book. I mean, you know, when I was younger, it was, you know, of course, it was black boots. Everybody had black boots, and then the game changed. And even when I was at Celtic, the likes of McGeady and Maloney would come to train with the first team in like different coloured boots. So you think, well, come on, you've got to earn the right, guys. But I think that, you know, there's a situation where now younger players, not just younger players, but there are people out there who are more worried about what they look like. You know, whether they've got the right footwear, whether they've got sweatbands, a hairband, a snood. I mean, what's a snood? And, you know, they'll switch off from who they're picking up from free kicks and corners because they're worried about, you know, looking good. And that, you know, that can't be right. That, you know, that's that was heavily tongue in cheek, that you know, that chapter. But there was, you know, the point that, come on, it's about what you do and not what you wear.
Tiger Woods was wearing a snood last week, so if he can do it, anyone can do it.
how hot was it then?
I think he's trying to protect his back, basically. He's trying to protect all his body from shutting down in coldness because he's got a bad back at that point. So, I don't know.
I've not heard that one.
Apparently that's one of the reasons for it.
Gloves is another thing, isn't it? I mean, some players wear have the short sleeve shirt and then wear gloves.
Doesn't make any sense.
Work that one out if you can.
I don't want to name names here, but Nicolas Otamendi, I remember him doing that once at a Christmas time fixture, short sleeves and gloves. Like, what are you doing? Yeah. What are you doing? Like, this makes absolutely zero sense whatsoever. I'm interested, actually, can you arrive at a point, or did you feel that you ever arrived at a point in your career and you were like, right, I can break out the white boots now. I can break out some color that's not black and feel comfortable in your own skin that you've arrived at that point in your career?
No, absolutely not. Because, I mean, I used to have a step over when I was at the 1920. It used to take me a few seconds to set up. But I always thought that if you're a Messi or you're a Ronaldo, then of course a player I played with at Celtic, Henrik Larsson, or a Mravchik, somebody who's a genius. Then do you know what? International players as well, players at the top of the game, wear what you like. But for the sort of rest of us, I think that we, you know, we all have to earn the right. And once we are there, once we're at the top, then yeah, have your golden boots, sit on your throne. But until then, work hard, keep striving, put the hard yards in, and don't worry about what your tattoos look like.
But hadn't you heard that white boots make you run faster?
No, and do you know what? That may have been my problem.
Like, I mean, maybe it's maybe you're putting the cart before the horse here a little bit. Maybe those players are so good because they wear those coloured boots rather than having the opportunity to wear those coloured boots because they are good.
You may well be right, but I very much doubt it. But the point about, you know, the players, and I know we laugh and joke about this, that the bigger point about the likes of your Larsons and your Ronaldos and your Messis is that they did put the hard yards in when they were younger. Mm. They, you know, it's all they thought about. Read a lot about Ronaldo. You know, he was a real student of the game. Every hour which he had, he practiced. Now he's, you know, leading on Instagram. He's got his brand all over the world. And do you know what? He deserves it. You take your hat off to people like that because they have put the work in. And that is the point about, you know, that particular chapter. It's about, you know, young people switching on early and rather than worrying about materialistic things, actually going out and training religiously and training hard. And ultimately, you know, my career, I thank my dad for that, because my dad was a former player, a school teacher, and he used to make me run cross country, which I hated. He used to take me in early in the mornings and do circuits at school. And you can imagine a moody teenager said, "I don't want to get out of bed, Dad." This, that, and the other. And he used to make me get up and sort of not force me to train, but really get behind me and talked about the importance of training, the importance of getting a real base fitness, because I was rejected at Norwich City when I was 12 years old. And it was those teenage years where he really, you know, pushed me and educated me on the importance of training, where I actually carved out a career for myself.
How important would you say your father was in you becoming a professional footballer and teaching you those values?
The main reason, by a stretch. Without those years, those teenage years, I've absolutely no doubt that I would have been doing something else, maybe working for the local county council or something. I really don't know. But, you know, it certainly was because I put the hard yards in. The years... Nobody likes being rejected. I was rejected at Norwich when I was 12 years old. They said I wasn't good enough. and I didn't like it. Thought that was my chance gone as a 12-year-old, of course, slightly immature. And then I got another opportunity when I was 16. But the work, just a trial period, but the work I'd done in those years, 13, 14, 15, and 16, which I put in physically and mentally, when I went back and got the opportunity with Norwich again, I was in a far stronger place mentally than the players who had gone up through the age groups, if that makes sense. Mm. And when I got that chance again, I felt I was far hungrier, where the boys who had been in the system had coasted. So I got that second opportunity and then quickly really established myself. But that was because of those years, the hard yards, not worrying about what boots and what shin pads and what sweatbands I was wearing. And I didn't have long hair as well, so I didn't have a hairband.
There's a lesson for that in everybody, I think, Chris, and it's not just, I guess, refined to your era, and that hasn't changed with time. The idea of coming up through the ranks of a football club is still something that is a very contentious issue. And we've discussed this quite a bit on the show in recent years about academies and about the idea of whether or not that's actually the right way to go. If getting poached as a 12, 13-year-old is good for you as a footballer, whereas if you go to a lower division, if you're an Irish footballer playing in the League of Ireland for a little while, establishing yourself as a young footballer at senior level, instead of getting babysat through these academies, it does seem to be that is the better way to go.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think, you know, if I look back to my own career, there was a pathway. Norwich City were a first division club, or the equivalent of a Premier League club back then. But when I broke into the youth team, you're one step away from the reserves. And of course, the reserves is one step away from the first team. There was a very small first team squad. And it was literally, if a first team player was injured, then, you know, the player who was playing well, they're the best in the reserves, would get that chance. So from very quickly playing for my school team, within a year, I was playing for Norwich City reserves against established first division players as they were back then, the likes of Roy Wegerle, Paul Walsh, Vinnie Samways, you know, good footballers. And I couldn't believe, you know, I wouldn't have believed that had somebody told me that the year previous, you know, when I wasn't attached to any club. And of course, then you get the confidence from that. And then I got my opportunity in the first team through an injury. Nowadays, I think if you're a young player, I think you make a good point, the pathway is blocked. You know, it's a numbers game. That's not to say some young players don't get through, because of course they do. But I think, you know, the sensible approach now for most young players is actually, you talked about the League of Ireland, and Scotland should be another breeding ground for developing players. But in England, certainly at Premier League level, the pathway is blocked. And then you have, you know, the likes of clubs. There's a chapter on stockpiling players, the likes of clubs, yeah, like Chelsea, Manchester United. It's a business within a business, isn't it? And it's a money-making scheme, but it certainly makes it more and more difficult for young players to make that breakthrough.
And even at the very top level, in the talents of the most incredible kids that we see coming through, it can be difficult. Like the Jadon Sancho case study is an interesting one at the moment, where he might end up playing for Manchester United, having not made the breakthrough at Manchester City. Now, of course, there are other complications around this, where had he waited another year, Pep Guardiola probably would have given him a chance the same time as Phil Foden. And there was a little bit of impatience on Jadon Sancho's side. At the same time, you applaud a kid for backing himself. I'm keen to get your take on that whole situation, and whether or not Manchester City will be regretting that, or is it actually just feeding into the whole idea of stockpiling players too much, and that's why City have found themselves in this situation?
Really interesting one, that, isn't it? I take my hat off to Jadon Sancho. I mean, there's a strong argument, you know, I don't know how you feel about this, and how, you know, other people feel about this, that Phil Foden, for his talent, still hasn't had enough game time for Manchester City. I think he's played this season is something like six Premier League appearances. I may be wrong, that's off the top of my head, but that's that's not enough. And then the last few seasons, I think we've all been saying this should be Phil Foden's season, you know, where he gets the opportunity. Now with David Silva leaving, we would expect him to get more game time. But I think that that with Jadon Sancho, he should be applauded for actually having the strength of character to say, well, do you know what? And the intelligence to look at the situation and think, do you know what? I'm not going to play here. And it's okay. I'll be training with great players every day. And that may benefit my development. But I want to go out and play games. And he went across to the Bundesliga and his reputation has really, really grown. And real credit to him for doing that. And now we see a lot of younger players actually following the same path. So in many respects, Jadon Sancho has been a pioneer.
It does seem that is like, exactly as you said it, you would not be surprised to see another bunch of youngsters following that exact same path at this moment. Instead of asking yourself, will I break into this Liverpool or City team? You know what? My agent's got a Bundesliga club lined up for me. Why not even just try it out for a year or two?
Yeah, and the Bundesliga is a fantastic league. You know, I'm a big fan of you know, the way the German teams play. But is that not a common sense approach? You know, it's not about what money they're earning. These boys are hungry. They want to get on. They want to establish themselves. And because of that, you know, I think it's a really sensible approach, and we're seeing it more and more often now. I mean, it's interesting, I think, is that Jude Bellingham, Manchester United, showing a strong interest in him, weren't they? And he's another one who's gone across to the Bundesliga. And it's something which now I think that the Premier League clubs will have to seriously start to think about, and maybe giving young... I mean, it may change in terms of their approach and thinking, well, do you know what? We might have to give these young, talented players more opportunity. But then, you know, there's another argument that managers are under so much pressure these days, you know, if they don't win within 4 or 5 games, if they lose 6 games on the trot, then they get the sack anyway. So, you know, that's another chapter.
It's a vicious cycle, isn't it? And it's actually interesting that post lockdown we saw potentially more kids getting just a little bit more game time, like Foden racking up a few more appearances. You had like Bukayo Saka and Mason Greenwood all of a sudden looking good, because there wasn't a transfer window for anybody to sign them replacements in the off-season, and the pressure that the managers feel couldn't be channeled into, you know, spending millions of pounds, and perhaps that was one of the reasons for that. One of the other things I wanted to ask you about in the book...
And the club...
Sorry, go on.
Yeah, and the clubs have assets now. I live in a place called Norfolk, which is, you know, the local club's Norwich City. Now, Norwich City, you know, when I got my breakthrough, it was a club renowned for developing youth players, and, you know, had a very good record of developing players. The likes of Craig Bellamy came through at Norwich City. For the older listeners, that, you know, the likes of Ruel Fox and Dale Gordon, and it was a you know, real conveyor belt. And then when the club got relegated from the Premier League under Alex Neil, they had players on huge wages. And Norwich, of course, came up with under Daniel Farke, got relegated again. But all last season, Daniel Farke was talking about the club paying for mistakes of the past financially. You know, the club were in a tricky situation. Therefore, they couldn't spend the money in the transfer market. They were looking to reduce the wage bill. What happened then? The club went and looked, what have we got developing in our own academy? The likes of Max Ahrens, Jamal Lewis, who was heavily linked with Liverpool, Todd Cantwell has come through, Ben Godfrey, a player who they brought from York, a young player, who, you know, see quoted as, you know, a figure sort of 30, 40 million for him, albeit I think he's got development to do. But now Norwich City, in their first team, they have players who have real value, who they have given the opportunity to. So there's a lesson there for Norwich, for Norwich and a lot of other clubs. And I hope Norwich stick with that model from now on in.
Yeah, it's far more sustainable. One of the things I wanted to ask you about from early in the book, it's one of the first chapters, I think, is we need to remind people that football is a contact sport, which is something that comes up quite a bit at the moment. Talk to us a little bit about this chapter and what your hypothesis is on this one.
Well, I don't think the difference with this book to a lot of other books, in my opinion, and it's only my opinion, of course, is that I do have a good sort of moan about various things, and that's the point of the book. But there are cures, and there are solutions. I don't want to give all the solutions away.
Sure.
But I would say this, and I don't want to sound like a grumpy old man, but if you went back 20 years to watch a game of football, not just Premier League, any football across the world, any division, that noise when two players are totally committed to a challenge, there is no better noise in the world than that, crunching into each other. There's it's a fantastic sound, isn't it? And I think we miss it. I think we really miss that now. And that's, that was the point. There's this law in about endangering players now, isn't there? Was he endangering an opponent? It's getting ridiculous. Players aren't going to allow. It'll be a non-contact sport eventually, the way things are going. What is endangering? Every time you go in for a challenge, there's some sort of danger there, isn't there? When you get out of bed in the morning, there's danger there. But it's I think things do need to change. And my view on that is if somebody comes off their feet now, and I commentate on games, and they win the ball and win the ball cleanly, what's the problem? Mm. What's the problem? I think most people feel that way, don't they?
Yeah, especially in a stadium. It is as big a roar as you can possibly get, I find. One of the questions I have around this particular section, what is your theory behind putting Terry Butcher ahead of Roy Keane on your hard man list?
The lists are sort of have been pretty controversial. They aren't the main part of the book. They're sort of little side plates, if you like. Do you know what? If I could change, I'd probably change that. No, I don't know. I don't know. I'm a big fan of both players. Terry Butcher frightens me to death, and I have to say, so does Roy Keane. So there was a nice variety. I wouldn't want to fall out with either, I can tell you. But football, just on that issue, the football and the contact. I think we have to ask ourselves this question: is football worse off with the fact that we don't see the ferocious challenges anymore, that physicality? And I think the answer to that is absolutely it's worse off, which is why we've gone so far the other way now. Eventually it will be very, very difficult to bring it back. So which is why, as a matter of urgency, really, we need to get back to just a semblance of, if there's a strong challenge, we can accept that. I mean, even with the chapter on law changes. I mean, now I don't know how you feel about watching a drop ball. I used to love watching a drop ball. You talk about Terry Butcher and Roy Keane. Imagine a drop ball. You're sitting in the stand, and Terry Butcher and Roy Keane are squaring up to each other just for something as simple as that. And we're all thinking, who's going to annihilate the other person, aren't we? Who's going to wipe out? That's what we're all thinking. Is that not excitement? Is that not part of the game and being a spectator? I think it is. It's great. That's what you talk to your family about. Wow, watch this. He's a nutcase, he is. Watch this. I mean, it's great, isn't it? It's just detracting from the game, this sort of, we'll give a free kick for that, a yellow card for that. Always endangering him. Dear me.
I think you make a comparison with David Attenborough in the book, the idea of endangering something. Everybody's endangered at the moment on the football pitch, it seems. One quick one on Roy Keane, actually, now that he's come up. I'd like to hear your take on Roy Keane as a pundit. Are you the character that he has in studio, Like, he comes across as ferocious quite often. At the same time, there's a cheeky smile there at the end of pretty much everything that he says. What's your view on Roy Keane, the pundit, when you're watching him?
Honestly, I think he is a superb watch. I think he's box office. I like him because he says what he thinks. He says what a lot of people think. And if they don't like it, lump it. That's his opinion. And most of the things he says makes perfect sense to most people. But he says it. He says things strongly. But that's the way he always was as a player. He speaks the truth. So, you know, I find him an intriguing watch. And he's one of the people, you know, if I know he's on television, I would without doubt turn it on. You know, he is one, he has his own opinion. He's not frightened to get stuck into other people who want to sit on the fence. And I thought he was a brilliant player. I was with him for 2 weeks at Celtic. And because he came when Gordon Strachan came in as manager. And I always had the utmost respect for him as a player, albeit, you know, in my younger days, I was at Blackburn Rovers and he was at Manchester United. So there was quite a strong rivalry there. But he was an outstanding player, and he's taken punditry by storm as well.
Is that something that you're conscious of as a pundit sometimes, that you don't want to upset the wrong people? Is that something that you've ever encountered?
No. I think the point about that is just being authentic, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, just saying what you feel. If people don't like it, then, you know, you form an argument. I mean, another chapter in the book is about interviews, post-match interviews. And I mean, I think we're all sick and tired. And you mentioned Roy Keane and, you know, why I like listening to him, because he tells the truth. I'm sick of listening to managers after games. You know, Arsene Wenger didn't see this, didn't see that. Just run of the mill interviews. And where it's just football spiel, isn't it? You know, at the end of the day, we're over the moon with the win, and, you know, we're all going to get on the coach, and we're happy with that. We want to hear managers come out and say what they actually feel about incidents, and be strong, because it's an entertainment industry, isn't it? But I mean, most and players as well, and I understand it was a player myself, where you have to come out after games and toe the party line, and, you know, it was a good point. But people don't want to hear that, do they? They want to hear about the big incidents in the game and people calling it as, you know, as most fans would call it.
There's a heap of other stuff that I wanted to get into, Chris, like about the match day experience in particular. The verbal abuse is covered in the book. You ask people to put away smartphones, which I wholeheartedly endorse, and that should be number one thing on the manifesto once football returns and people are back in stadiums. The one last thing I did want to ask you about, though, because it's a really important issue, is about how football needs to properly tackle the dementia issue. Just for explain to people who haven't read the book yet why this is a personal thing for you.
Yeah, well, my dad was a former player, and he's now in a care home not far from where I live. He suffers from dementia. He's probably had it for now. I was discussing this with my mum just a couple of weeks ago, I think for the best part of a decade. And he's in a really bad way now, where, you know, he doesn't know how to eat. He can't toilet properly. I'll go and see him. He doesn't know who I am. He doesn't know who my mum is. And it's been a gradual decline from, you know, being forgetful initially where his car keys were. And he's a local Norwich man. And the first real sign of concern from our point of view was when he went to watch my son play football locally, and he took his car and he couldn't find his way home. And from then on, I mean, you can imagine, I mean, he knows the county, he knew every road in the county, that we started to get quite scared and fearful of what was actually going on. And he's just been in a gradual decline, and you know, he's given medication, and there's all sorts of balances which the doctors have to figure out. And now he's a shadow of what he once was. He's not there anymore. I'll go and sit with him. I'll hold his hand. I'll talk to him. And I just hope that in the hope that something is getting through. And there's a lot of other people who suffer as well. My mum, has been with my dad for 56 years, and it's heartbreaking for her in the early days. And for years she looked after him, but he would go, he would go missing, and we'd get calls from people saying where he was. And it was such a worry, but it just became impossible for my mum to look after my dad. It was taking a massive toll on her life, hence why that he's in a care home now. And the care home which he's in, he's looked after absolutely brilliantly with him. And I mean, it's a thankless task, and it's been very, very hard with the COVID situation where, we couldn't see him for months. And, went to see him the other week, and he came down and was brought down by a carer, is in a wheelchair now. He can't stand up, and there's nothing left of him. And he was a strong man, a strong character, an intelligent man. And I know this, this isn't an isolated incident in terms of former players. It's been a problem for so many years, and it hasn't been tackled with properly. The likes of Dawn Astell, whose father Jeff Astell died from dementia. It was called Boxer's Brain at the public inquiry, I think it was, and that verdict was never recognised. An industrial disease verdict was never recognised. And the PFA, the Players Union, my gripe with this is that the head of the Players Union, Gordon Taylor, it's his duty of care to look after former players and professionals like my father, and he knew that there was a testing process which was put into place. This testing process stopped. Gordon Taylor, the head of the Players Union, knew that the testing had stopped and never flagged it up for over a decade. What could have happened within that decade had Gordon Taylor, and it was his duty to do so, had he just said, okay, the testing has stopped for whatever reason, because these things don't always work, and we understand that. But what a difference that could have made, that 10 years. It's not going to save my dad. My dad is dying the most horrible, horrible death imaginable. But it may save future generations to come. What will happen, the way things are going, and this will happen, is the likes of my generation, 15 years on, 20 years on, even less than that, family members, when we are suffering from dementia, will say, why on earth didn't we do something? Why on earth was there not more effort put into funding to try and finding what this link is between heading the football and dementia? Because it is there. The studies have been done. I think you're five times more likely to get Alzheimer's if you had a football, three and a half times more likely to get dementia. There is something in that, and there should be a far greater urgency within the game than there is. And I think that's a massive problem. We see a lot of high profile footballers who like to talk about politics and get involved and have their opinions. Why aren't we talking about dementia? And I for the life of me, I do not understand that. But what chance do we have when you have the head of the PFA, an organisation which was set up to look after its members, when the duty of care just wasn't there for the likes of my dad and thousands of other footballers and their families? But these ex-players are rotting away. They are rotting away in care homes, and they aren't getting the support which they should have.
The story you tell there obviously crystallizes it perfectly for you. Obviously, we've seen Alan Shearer he did a documentary on it, obviously, a couple of years ago. He's been one of the voices at the forefront of this. It does seem, as you point out, that this conversation kind of comes and goes. We have a documentary like Alan's one, and then the conversation disappears for a while. We have Dawn Astell and, I mean, the great work that she's done, and then it kind of disappears for a while. It doesn't necessarily seem that there is wheels in motion to actually affect change on this. We have, however, seen things come in about heading being banned for underage football, and I know it's been banned in the United States. There's wheels in motion on that front in the UK as well. Is this something that you talk a lot about with your peers, and is it something that you're conscious of and worried about for yourself? Because I know you would have headed the ball quite a bit during your playing days.
Yeah, I don't think that I don't think about myself, because I've had my career. What happened, and I'm actually of the view there's little point in worrying for worrying's sake about that. Mm. I think my wife's worried, my children are slightly worried naturally. No, I think that the steps for banning heading in the younger age groups is certainly a very, very sensible step. There, I mean, I used to go and head balls on afternoons because that's a good way of practicing, you know, a fundamental in football. But I used to head balls, and the balls weren't great back then. And I'm not saying a lot of people talk about there being a better quality ball now. Well, it doesn't really matter. It's the force, isn't it, which you're heading a ball, which is the issue. But, you know, I'd go out Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday afternoons and maybe hit 100 balls, maybe more than that, when I was a youth team player at Norwich. Had I known back then what I know now, and a coach would have asked me to go out and head footballs or that number of footballs, I would have absolutely not done that. Absolutely not. And it's about education. It's about choice. What is the upside of children under 11 heading a football anyway? There is no upside. Your brain isn't properly formed then. The studies have been done about, I think if you head more than, I think if there was a stat that if you head more than 20 balls in a day or 20 balls every day, then your memory will be impaired for the next 24 hours. You'll have memory loss for the next 24 hours. You know, these are facts.
I think short-term memory moments like that or anything?
I'm not sure, really. Right. You know, I forget a lot of things, but, you know, I suppose most people do as well. So I'm not sure. I'm just conscious I have children and I want what's best for them. And I mentioned this situation about when in another 15 years, our generation, this will absolutely happen. We will still be in the same situation in 15, 20 years if we don't actually all pull a finger out and get on with the task. And that means increased funding into trying to really find out what on earth is going on. And families, there will be such a frustration, because you mentioned Dawn Astell. She's campaigned for years about this. I've spoken to Dawn on many, many occasions. The likes of John Stiles, his dad, Nobby Stiles, you remember, a World Cup winner, another man, is rotting away in a care home. And there are hundreds and hundreds of cases like that. And what happens is every so often there's a little bit of momentum there. And I've been there myself probably three or four times now over the years. And you think, that's good. After the Alan Shearer documentary, we are getting somewhere with this. We are making progress. And then what happens is it just grinds to a halt. And then, you know, the anger starts. And, you know, I speak to Dawn, who's been a leading light with this. But it is so, so demoralizing. But this is going to be a vicious circle. This is going to be a continuous cycle. It's not going to stop. And unless you actually know somebody who's affected, as you know, as my dad is affected, and unless you actually can sit there and see the decline, I mean, it's awful. It really is. You know, it's heartbreaking. It is.
Yeah, like I completely agree with you that there tends to be wheels in motion every so often. How do we make this a more sustained thing?
Well, finance, money is important, of course. Research is important, but will is the most important thing. The will within the game. Having somebody who is at the head of the players' union who cares, who does the right thing. Gordon Taylor may have done a lot of things good for football players over however many years he's been in charge, 40 years. He may have done a lot of good things. With dementia, he has been an absolute disgrace with it. And he's never, ever, ever once come out and explained why when the testing stopped and there was more than a decade of silence, he's never given a satisfactory on record as why he didn't flag it up then. And he knew that. So how on earth are we going to get on top of the fight against dementia when you have a man like him in charge? It's not going to happen. And he surrounded himself with a power base of people. And, you know, he's a very, very clever man. He is a great survivor. That's what he is. But, you know, the reality is my dad was a former professional footballer. And there are thousands of others around the country. You only have to look at the numbers. And, you know, I said many times in the last 5 minutes, they are dying the most degrading, they're dying in such a manner. It's the most horrible, horrible way to die. You know, losing your faculties, not being able to eat properly, not being able to know what to walk to toilet. I mean, it doesn't get any worse than that. He can't brush his hair, he can't clean it. He doesn't know what he's doing. He just sits there staring into space. That's what he does. And it's not getting any better. It's just been a gradual decline. It's eating away at him. It's a cruel disease. There's no life.
Mm. No, absolutely. It's like when you read the book, Chris, in fairness, it's very hard to think of an issue in football that is more important than this at the moment. And it is just astonishing that perhaps what we see in football discourse doesn't represent that fact. We've kept you here for long enough, Chris. I really appreciate your time. As you can probably tell from the last half an hour or so, you're better than that. How to Fix Modern Football is a brilliant book. There is many more of Chris's thoughts on dementia, on heading the ball inside in the book. There's other important issues, perhaps less important, but important nonetheless, covered within. And there's also some really funny moments in it as well, as hopefully we tried to get across today. Chris, thanks a million for taking the call. Best of luck with the book. And I know we're going to chat to you again soon on our Off the Ball Roadshow, where you'll be delivering some great Celtic memories.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
The OTB Podcast Network with Virgin Media. Catch all of the UEFA Champions League and Europa League games live on Virgin Media TV.